Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Last Friday, in more than 100 countries around the world, students skipped school, and this is what it sounded like.
Adults all around the world not only stand in solidarity with us, but that they act on climate change.
Students again from around the world in the global climate strike. Now, some teachers and politicians scolded them for skipping class, but the students are scolding louder, holding adults to account for letting climate change destroy their futures as they see it. And they say they'll keep doing it until the grown-ups grow up. This hour on Point, the worldwide student climate protest movement, and you can join us. What do you make of this movement? Did you or a young person you know march last Friday? And do you think it will make a difference? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, we're going to speak with three students from around the world this hour, but we'll start right here in the United States. Filiquan Charlemagne joins us from Ocala, Florida. He's a 17-year-old high school student and national creative director for Youth Climate Strike USA. Filiquan, welcome to On Point.
Hey, nice to be here, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us what, I mean, you've been obviously active for a while in issues of climate change, but what drew you to the streets on Friday?
Okay, so what really drew me to the streets, the reason I got involved with the climate strike USA and really the movement as a whole is really how climate change has affected my life as a whole. And so I'm an immigrant from St. Thomas, actually, a small island in the Caribbean. Affected myself and my family and really, you know, my entire culture so much. Hurricane Irma is just really one hurricane in a long list of natural disasters that have gotten worse and worse throughout my entire life and have just continually affected my island, surrounding islands, and yeah, really there. And so here in Florida, you know, we moved here to Florida for like a better chance, but really that's not a sustainable solution because here in the U.S., Florida is going to be one of the first hit and one of the most hardly hit by climate change. And we already see that really with increasing hurricanes,
yeah.
Like Hurricane Michael and, like I mentioned, Hurricane Irma hit my island, but it really hit South Florida really badly as well.
So what were you and other students demanding for on Friday? What are you asking for adults and leaders around the world to do?
So really the main center of everything is really science-based action to follow the IPCC report. And what that really comes into is things like we want the Green New Deal. We don't want any new fossil fuel infrastructure projects. We want a national emergency on climate change because it truly is a national emergency. We need compulsory comprehensive education on climate change and its impacts through grades K through 8. We need our water supply to be clean. We need to preserve our public lands and wildlife, really things like that. And then beyond that, as an organization, we allowed local chapters to have the integrity to really demand their own things that are really personal to them and their cities. Because, for example, here in Florida, I'm also the Florida State lead, and we have in Miami the climate crisis really affects them in different ways than it's going to affect everywhere else inside of the U.S. And so they have a huge crisis there with rising waters where the beaches continually get more and more polluted, more and more worse off. And to solve the problem, these city governments are literally dumping sand into the beaches so that the waterfronts don't get, you know, overcome by water. And that in turn makes the problem worse. You're just fixing problems caused by pollution with pollution. And so the students down there demand that their government stop doing that.
Now, so you actually have a very specific list of ideas and demands, which is, you know, it's a terrific start, actually. And I hear your urgency about you and your fellow students feel like we have to do this right now. I mean, that IPCC report from last year was quite an eye opener. But Filiquan, I'm wondering if you could actually just give us some insight into, I mean, you're clearly a student activist as well. You care a lot about this. But on a day-to-day basis, How is it that you and your fellow young people sort of talk about climate change? How much is it part of your consciousness and the world that you're living in now? Because it's one thing to gather for a protest, very public, very profound way of drawing attention to a matter. But I'm curious about how much this issue sort of is part of your everyday lives.
So, yeah, it's kind of actually scary in that sense, because I feel like it's almost never talked about in school and among my peers beyond the activists that I know. And that's part of the reason that it's such an urgent issue, because it's literally one of the biggest crises in our life. And what you see is that only a select few people are talking about it. Even last year in the 2016 presidential election, in the Democratic debates, climate change was not mentioned a single time. And that's just really scary to think about, that even the people who supposedly care the most about it don't even talk about it enough.
Yeah. So if you had a chance to speak directly to a national or a set of international leaders, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that we need action now. Like, this is our futures, and there's really no other time now. This is one Earth. We have one Earth. They say there's no planet B, and that's just completely true. There's nothing that we can do but solve this crisis. And if we really don't act now and on a global scale, then there's really bad things to come.
Mm. Well, Filiquan Charlemagne from Ocala, Florida, 17-year-old high school student and national creative director for Youth Climate Strike USA, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Andrew Revkin. He is joining us from New York. He's strategic advisor for environmental and science journalism at the National Geographic Society. He's been covering global warming and climate change for 30 years, and he's co-author with Lisa Micheli of Weather, An Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change. Andrew Revkin, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here. And yeah, I do feel like a graybeard a little bit on this stuff.
Don't we all? Okay. But first of all, tell us, you've been watching environmental movements for some time. What do you make of the fact that so many young people now, managed to pull off what may be one of the largest environmental strikes in history on Friday?
It's amazing to behold. And I do think social media, the connectivity we have now around the world, can play a big role in building these kinds of movements. There's a website right now you can go to for the to keep track of how many countries. It was from Albania to Venezuela, theoretically, amid all the crisis there, someone had pulled together a protest as well. It builds a lot on some earlier things, 350.org, Bill McKibben, who started writing about climate change around the same time I did and took a more campaigner path. 350.org, built around the number 350 parts per million of this greenhouse gas in the atmosphere as a goal. And they created a pretty amazing global movement, even as Twitter was just getting started, more than a decade ago. In 2000, at the climate talks in The Hague in the Netherlands, a young person tossed a pie, and I wrote about this at the time, into the face of a U.S. Delegate because they thought they weren't getting serious enough. In 2005, there was this really interesting Fossil of the Day award that was put out mostly by a group focused on energy action. That was the name of one of the groups to highlight the inaction and the gray beards. And that was the first time I saw signs saying, whose climate is it anyway? So it's what we're seeing now, I think, has built in a long period over of kids and young people, college age and beyond, who are really figuring out this is an issue that's here for a long time to come. Let's make sure people don't lose track of it amid the flow of news and the like.
Right. And so, you heard Filiquan Charlemagne just say that not only has he sort of seen or thought a lot about climate change, but he feels like he and his family have personally experienced it, right? And he talked about Hurricane Irma. Is that part of what, I heard you say this is a natural sort of outgrowth of many years of climate activism, but it feels like something might be slightly different here in terms of what Filiquan actually said, that the chickens, in a sense, are coming home to roost, and it's like physically unavoidable to see the effects of a more uncertain climate. Is that part of what you think is driving some of these young people?
Well, you framed it very well there by saying it's not so much uncertain as there are two things going on in the world right now that have kind of ramped up what we see in the headlines. One is where and how we build. And of course, having 9 billion, we're heading toward 9 billion people from When I was 12, there were 2.7 billion people. And many of us, rich and poor, have settled in places that are prone to hurricanes and wildfires in the West and flooding in river valleys like we're seeing out in the Midwest right now.
In Nebraska, that's right, yeah.
So, and that's why, you know, when I looked at, I wrote recently in Nat Geo on the Green New Deal, and I liked seeing, it's not just about the sort of simple idea, we need to have an emergency and, you know, fix things. There was a word in there, resilience. As we do this stuff, we have to figure out how to have a more resilient relationship with this system around us. We've built a huge amount of vulnerability, and greenhouse gases are building in the air, and that's amplifying that vulnerability for, you know, age, literally generations to come.
So then, I mean, we're going to explore this a little more deeply throughout the hour, but young people always take the risk of not being taken seriously. And look, we even have, we've got comments coming here online, for example, from a listener, Stephen Haim, saying if they're happy to drastically reduce their standards of living and wreck the economy for no appreciable effect on the climate, that's their problem, not mine. I would say, I mean, that's Stephen Haim's point of view there. But despite that risk of not being taken seriously, is there, do you see some potential long-term effectiveness with this new sort of climate activism amongst ever younger and younger people?
Well, I guess I'll look at the history of those I met at the climate talks and in protests in 2005. And so they're all, many of them have shape not only their educations, but now their careers of going forward around this. One young man, Josh Tulkin, who I met in Montreal in 2005, he was 24 at the time, so he was already a grown-up-ish. And he's now running the Maryland Sierra Club chapter. You know, there's a stick-to-itiveness about many young people I see. Billy Parrish out in California was a barefoot protester in Montreal, and now he's running a solar finance thing. So it's possible to stick with it and stay serious.
All right. Well, we are talking about the worldwide student climate strike that took place last Friday in more than 100 countries on planet Earth. And we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. What do you make of this surge of youth activism around climate? Do you think it'll be effective? And were you one of the people who took to the streets? Andrew, hang on here for just a minute. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about last Friday's worldwide climate strike held by students in more than 100 countries around the world. And we're joined today by Andrew Revkin. He's strategic advisor for environmental and science journalism at the National Geographic Society. And we want to hear from you. What's your question for the young people who took to the streets last Friday demanding that adults be more proactive in doing something about climate change? Now, last week's coordinated global school strikes were inspired by now 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. She began holding solitary demonstrations outside the Swedish parliament about climate change last year. She's been recently nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, by the way. She also spoke to negotiators at the UN climate talks in Poland last December, and here's part of what she said.
The year 2078, I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend that day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you. Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything while there still was time to act. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you are stealing their future in front of their very eyes.
That's Greta Thunberg speaking to negotiators at the UN climate talks in Poland last December. Joining us now from the Philippines is Krishna Ariola. She's a 24-year-old fourth-year psychology student, and she organized the protest in her part of the Philippines and plans to continue climate protest in Fridays to come. Krishna, welcome to On Point.
Hello, good evening.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Also with us from Exeter, England, is Sophie Sleeman. She is a 17-year-old student doing her A-levels at Exeter College, and she's co-organizer of the protest that took place in Exeter in England and a member of the UK Student Climate Network as well. Sophie, welcome to you.
Hi, great to be here.
It's great to have both of you. Krishna, let me just start with you. First of all, I mean, you're living in a nation that's very vulnerable to the effects of climate change. Can you just tell me, in your lifetime already, how have you seen the climate change in the Philippines?
I guess living in a country that ranks third in climate change vulnerability, I've seen typhoons have been a regular thing here. We have an average of 20 typhoons per year, and basically our lives revolve around mitigating and reacting to it. And yeah, so it's climate change is our daily reality. And we also have four seasons here in the Philippines, and we are also an agro-industrial country, so we're really dependent on our agriculture industry to survive.
And what's your response then to some, even political leaders who say taking to the streets for a day isn't going to do much and they would have rather had young people stay in school on Friday?
I guess this is our education in action. What we learned inside the classrooms, we are applying it now in real life. What good would it do to just take in all the lessons and not act upon it when we know that we can do something? Because the climate crisis isn't something that one individual can solve. It has to be a collective effort. And since we are young people, we are not in powerful positions to actually do something significant, we are crying out to the leaders who are in those positions to actually resolve this problem in a more sustainable and urgent manner.
So, Sophie Sleeman, in Exeter, England, what are you demanding that your political leaders, your adults, do?
We want them really to go carbon neutral by 2030 at the latest, because in terms of our local council, they recently released that they were going to go carbon neutral by 2050. But by then, it's going to be way too late. We'll already be suffering the effects of climate change, as it is evident in other countries such as the Philippines. And they released this goal for their carbon emissions that didn't even use the words climate emergency, which is what we were pushing throughout February. And then at the end of February, they released this report, and it just wasn't good enough. So that's really what we want them to demand, is lower carbon emissions, and then how that will affect their structure of society as a whole. So how we approach public transport and agriculture and education especially as well.
Interesting. So I've been hearing sort of recurrent calls by young people to accelerate the pace of change to deal with climate change. But we've got some comments, Sophie, coming in here from some of our listeners. Someone says a green revolution could provide enough jobs in manufacturing to maintain a decent standard of living while phasing out fossil fuels-based pollution. But the shift will lead to massive changes in our economic models and politics. Are we ready? Can we handle the risk? I mean, Sophie, are you worried about the disruption that might come with a more rapid pace of change as you're demanding for?
I think that if we focus on the effects on individuals' lives, then we are going to feel this rapid change a lot stronger. But if we focus on how we can make our public spaces better for everyone, then the ease of change is going to be a lot softer. Of course, there are going to be drawbacks to people's personal lives. If you can't own a car, if you can't have all these possessions as much, then you are going to feel the change a lot harder. But if you focus on making, say, your public parks greener and your public transport faster and more sustainable, then the society that we're transitioning to is actually going to be better than the one we have now. So then the change is going to be kind of soft and nice, rather than, oh, we're not getting these consumer products as much as we are now.
So Krishna, what do you think about that?
I think it only feels like it's disruptive and drastic because we haven't started in so long. We have been doing climate talks for over 30 years, and I think it's long overdue. That's why it's going to be disruptive now, because we need to start today. And I guess people are so afraid of change, and that's why we're kickstarting the movement, because people need to understand that we are in a climate emergency and we need to be able to adapt to the drastic changes.
Yeah. Well, Andrew Revkin, advisor for environmental and science journalism at the National Geographic Society, let me turn back to you here, because you've been listening to Krishna and Sophie. And I mean, to Krishna's point, I mean, she's pointing out that, like, had change come along 30 years ago, perhaps the disruption wouldn't be so great. And they're willing to accept the risk of the transformation that they're asking in economies and politics around the world. That's a message, though, that seems to be a little difficult to sell to people who are in power right now.
Yes, but the yes, but is like the Green New Deal. What's so interesting, the Green New Deal is, you know, people a little, just a notch older than many of the kids who were in the streets. But it's a vision of a new path. It has all kinds of controversy around it. But when you look carefully at it, as I did in a recent National Geographic piece, you see that it's laying out. Actually, at its core, it is a realistic thing. We need to engage on resilience. This is that issue in the Philippines and so many other places. There's so much that can be done now, like today and next week and next year, to have more resilient communities and places prone to fire and flood. We saw that in California. There were houses that didn't burn down. Focusing on those students in areas that have that risk can get deeply involved in charting out, hey, why is our community still so vulnerable? Even as we work out this big CO2 problem, the climate, you know, greenhouse gas problem, let's make our community more robust. And that can lead to more engagement in other ways. One place that is taking kids seriously is National Geographic Society. I'm at the .org part, like the grant-making part. And for years, the grants there have had two tracks. One is what they call early career folks. And this is not just scientists. It's conservation efforts. It's projects that involve education. The early career grants are for anyone 18 and up. So that's like money, up to like $10,000 to get a project going on resilience in a community or a low carbon future or some way to sustain biodiversity in the middle of all these discussions. And so, you know, there are people out there who are able to help make this a journey, and not so much. I think the key challenge is to make it a journey and not just the one day in the street. What do you do back in school? And what do you do? There are schools I've seen in many places I go to speak where the learning is the doing, as you heard a minute ago from one of the young people. That's the place to really start where you can get traction and not just wait for grown-ups, quote-unquote, to do the work.
Right. So, Sophie Sleeman, let me turn back to you. Are you seeing more, you know, of the learning, or the question that Andrew asked about what are you going to do the next day and the day after that?
In terms of getting involved in this movement, I've been exposed to so much more, like articles and documentaries and other activists who've been suggesting ways that I can change my lifestyle. And it's just made me more aware of what I do in my personal life in regards to helping the climate. Mm-hmm. And because now I'm in this position where I've been involved in organizing a strike, people are more likely to actually talk to me for advice about how they can change their lifestyle. And I think we've kind of now brought climate change into the public discussion.
Yeah.
Now we're opening up the chance to change and the chance to bring these changes. And we just have to work out how we're going to do that right now.
But Sophie, if I may ask...
Can I add one more?
Yeah, go ahead, Andrew. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing that I've seen... my wife, who co-wrote that book with me, is an environmental educator. And they did this thing at a school where they do a boiler room tour. They go to the boiler room, the place that keeps the school warm or cool. And they started to build their learning around the school as a system. So it's like, I think there are these great opportunities, and that's something that can happen literally tomorrow at any school. Kids can say to their teacher, hey, how does this school work? Mm-hmm. And then that can build to, how does this community work? And that can build to other things I've seen. Pace University has an environmental clinic. It's a course where they take on a problem.
Right.
And so it's like... I think there's more power there than some people think.
Well, the quick question I was going to ask both Sophie and Krishna is, I don't know if you had a chance to hear Philiquan Charlemagne, who we spoke to from Florida at the top of the show, but he actually said that outside of his kind of core group of very climate-aware young activists. The part of the problem he sees is that issues of climate change aren't actually, you know, much discussed on a day-to-day basis, both, you know, as at his level as a 17-year-old and as he sees, you know, at higher levels as well. So Krishna, let me just start with you. I mean, honestly speaking, amongst your peers, is this urgency around climate felt? Is it discussed?
In the Philippine context, it's actually not discussed at all, considering our political climate as well, with our government and all of that. But here in our local community, in our province in Negros, we are actually very active in the environmental advocacy. And what we're trying to do is actually start those discussions. For example, I'm part of the organization that's called Youth for Climate Hope. And we are an organization that sees these opportunities in a more positive light, sees these things as an opportunity to start discussions. And we have camps, we do forums, seminars, and workshops in our community to discuss these things, because we are also an archipelago, and a lot of our coastal areas also experience sea level rise, and a lot of houses go under the water, and we have to adjust to that. We equip them with disaster risk reduction and mitigation. And yeah, we try to kickstart the movement from the grassroots level.
Well, Sophie, I'm going to come back to you here for a second, but in a minute. But let me just go to the callers very quickly. Let's go to Salima, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Salima, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Salima.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, yes. So last Friday, I was one of the youth that took part in the climate strike. I went to D.C. to kind of show my solidarity with the other climate change activists and other youth who are fighting to have their voices heard, especially in today's political climate, where at times it can seem a bit desperate and as if you're kind of just shouting into a void.
Well, Salima, thank you so much for your call. And before I let you go, let me just ask you a quick question. We've got, it seems like there's a lot of pushback coming online, like on our Facebook page. Someone says, someone named Jeffrey Radu says, the proposed solutions will do nothing to stop climate change, but they will destroy the United States. The fact that the left is so willing to exploit children is shameless. Salima, do you feel exploited?
I don't feel exploited because no one's forcing me to do anything. I, with my own 2 feet, I went and I striked with my fellow students, and I did so because I see the damage that's being done. Living in Maryland, the Chesapeake Bay is right there. It's a central part to many people's lives. If you look on the islands off the bay, especially Tangier Island, you can see the effects of climate change clearly as the island is sinking and continues to sink after every hurricane, after every major weather event. And it's kids aren't being used by, we aren't political actors. We aren't being used by some organization. It's us saying this with our own voice. And in that sense, it just goes to show that kids are continuously like, this is just another way to downplay our voice in today's political climate. And it's not going to work.
Well, Salima, thank you so much for your call. Sophie Sleeman, I've just got about 30 seconds left to go with you here. I want to ask you this, the same question here, because it keeps coming up in our online comments. Do you feel as if you're being exploited by other adults to advance their agendas?
No, I've actually received the same comment myself on a personal level. I think people have been telling me that you've been indoctrinated by your teachers, which is completely stupid, really, because one of the demands of our movement is that education treat climate change more seriously. So how could we have been somehow exploited by other adults in our lives, which are fundamentally our parents and our teachers, when those are the exact people that we want to change? And it was kind of mentioned earlier that climate change wasn't even mentioned in the democratic elections. So how can it be that the left is somehow exploiting us if they're not even talking about it themselves?
Well, Sophie Sleeman, a 17-year-old student at Exeter College, joining us from Exeter, England, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
All right. Well, I want to bring in another voice here. Tom Mayer joins us from West Lafayette, Indiana. He is a lecturer in sociology at Purdue University, and his research focuses on youth activism and social movements. Tom Mayer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm wondering if you could just pick up on where we are right now, because, again, it keeps coming up. Why is it that some people are saying that they feel that these young people are being exploited and being, I don't know, brainwashed into going out on the streets and marching against climate change?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it speaks to a broader phenomenon where we see young people as being is not having enough knowledge or education to engage in the political process. And so they're at a sort of deficit of knowledge that has to be filled in to participate. And as a result, when young people like those involved with the global climate strike start talking about issues, the presumption is, well, they don't know enough to talk about this, so clearly they're getting this from outside, and they're getting this from other participants.
Well, Tom, Krishna, and Andrew, hang on here for just a minute. We are talking about the worldwide student climate strike that happened last Friday in more than 100 countries on planet Earth. And what's your question about young people becoming active when it comes to demanding that adults do more to deal with climate change now? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about last Friday's worldwide student climate strike. And we're joined today by Krishna Ariola. She's with us from the Philippines. She's a 20-year-old fourth-year psychology student, and she organized the protests in her area of the Philippines and plans to continue her protests on Fridays to come. Andrew Revkin also joins us. He's strategic advisor for environmental and science journalism at the National Geographic Society. And Tom Mayer is with us. He lectures in sociology at Purdue University, and his research focuses on youth activism and social movements. Now, versions of these strikes have been going on, maybe smaller versions, for some time now. In November, thousands of Australian students walked out of school on a Friday to protest government inaction on climate change. And in the days leading up to that protest, Prime Minister Scott Morrison addressed the Australian Parliament, voicing his opinion against the student protests.
We do not support our schools being turned into parliaments, Mr. Speaker. What we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
That's the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison last year. Now, earlier in the show, we mentioned 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who's been holding demonstrations, individual demonstrations outside the Swedish parliament since last year. She inspired these other international actions. She addressed negotiators at the UN climate talks in Poland last December, and here's more of what she said.
You only speak of green, eternal economic growth because you are too scared of being unpopular. You only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children. But I don't care about being popular. I care about climate justice and a living planet.
Greta Thunberg addressing negotiators at the UN climate talks in Poland last December. Tom Mayer, let me turn to you here. I mean, you've been studying youth movements for quite a while. From what you see now, in terms of this coalescing student activism around climate change, do you think it has sticking power?
That's always a question with social movements. And it's always a challenge with social movements is to maintain the energy and mobility of keeping people engaged. And one of the bigger questions is not just sticking power in terms of the protests, but sticking power in terms of its impact on media coverage, its impact on individual participants' lives, and its impact on policy discussion as well.
And so do you think it could have that impact, though? I mean, we're talking about it now in the media, right?
Certainly. And I think one of the things that's different about this particular event is that you have a global mobilization around it. And climate change has always been a collective action problem. And to have mobilization across multiple different countries with a wide variety of individuals who are all participating, there's certainly the potential to have long-term impact in terms of this particular movement.
Well, Andrew Revkin, let me ask you something about this. Sure. You know, you were saying earlier how when you studied previous young climate activists, they you know, it stayed central to their lives in terms of the professions that they went into. I mean, it is entirely possible that many of these, you know, million or a couple of million young people who marched on Friday will stay active in this and perhaps in coming decades maybe even become leaders, political leaders, who can possibly affect even greater change. But isn't the sort of tension, one of the tensions here is that people like Krishna are asking for change now relying on them, you know, to do something when they have the levers of power is going to be too late.
Well, it's, you know, I've been writing this "Is It Too Late" story for, well, not for 30 years. The first one in 1988 was back when we assumed if we wrote lots of great stories about global warming and politicians talked about it, things would just magically happen. And what I learned through that 30-year process is that it's a long journey, and there's this weird weird paradox. It feels like a paradox of how do you mix urgency and patience? Those two words, I kind of ask people sometimes, roll those two words around in your brain, and what you come out with is sustained engagement. And the good news about climate change is that is the same as the bad news. The bad news is it's really big and global and has all these elements that make it hard to fix, quote unquote. The good news in the same statement is that everybody can play a part. That's why I was really thrilled to hear that the young woman from the Philippines is studying psychology. You know, one of the huge – actually, tomorrow, I didn't even think about this. There's a big meeting on what's the role of behavior change in solving the climate problem. So climate change, behavior change, that's a big gap in our understanding is how the brain works on these big complicated problems. And it's not just global warming. It's biodiversity loss, everything that has that long time scale. That's a research frontier. So even as young people get busy, you know, making the point politically as individuals and either future or current voters, that's where the other part can be getting, you know, pursuing a course of study and then, or a classroom project again that can actually make a difference in your community. It's all like more doable than ever. And that's a source of hope. But it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah. Well, so Krishna Ariola, the 20-year-old in the Philippines who's still with us. I mean, Krishna, how much do you see of your efforts, or as you know, as we just said, you're a psychology student as well, as going into trying to change people's attitudes or beliefs around climate change?
Yeah, I guess individual behavior change is something that really needs to be to be kickstarted here in the Philippines, especially because, as I said, our current government is taking all the headlines. And what we're trying to do here in our community is localize the problems of climate change, because climate is such a big concept, such an abstract concept to some people. But what we do is we localize these things in ways that they can understand. For example, our rising temperatures, the sea level rise, the lack of fish near the shore line, they have to go to the middle of the ocean to actually catch fish now. And it's in those things, it's in those points of discussion that we can actually reach them, that we can actually affect behavior change. And at the same time, we are not only talking to affected communities, but also to student leaders like us, so that they can kickstart movements in their own circle, in their own academic circle. And it's a seed that keeps on growing, I guess, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to John, who's calling from Carlisle, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you. So I'm in my mid-20s, and I've worked in sustainable agriculture and in outdoors education, so this is definitely something I'm pretty passionate about. But one thing I've noticed is that I'm from Massachusetts. This is something my peers are super aware of. Everyone knows about it, to different degrees of information about how severe the problem is. But like some of the activists were saying, not a lot of us talk about it very often. And I think part of it is that when I'll bring this topic up or someone else will bring this topic up, it's really easy for people to fall into sort of despair or fatalism because the problem is so overwhelming, and it's really scary. And I think that's one thing that maybe we haven't given enough credit to, and I think maybe the media has played a role in, like, hope is important, but also being too hopeful and not really showing quite how dire the problem is at times. Like, I would imagine this should be front page news every single day if people really knew what was going on. And so there's, like, sort of a grieving process that I've found has had to happen for me personally to move to a point where I actually can get past the fatalism and then do, you know, still keep doing the work to try and make my community more resilient. But a lot of people haven't put that level of reflection and time into it because they've got so many other things going on and they haven't made it as central to their life. And so I think there's a role for leadership, both whether it's spiritually, but also in the media and politically on that front. And how do we process this despair?
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Tom Mayer, what do you make of John's observation that it takes work to get past the fatalism of it all?
That's a great point. And threat is really a strong motivator for social movements. It's perhaps one of the strongest motivators for social movements. But as the caller pointed out, there's a real fine line between motivation and debilitation, it being debilitating and really deterring action. And the challenge is, as the caller kind of alluded to, is recognizing that threat as a motivation to get out in the streets and to get involved, but also seeing one's own actions and engagement and agency as a part of the process, as a form of hope and as a form of creating change to try and address those problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew Revkin, the flip side of this comes in the numerous online comments we're getting that are really challenging the very notion of urgency around the climate. For example, someone calling themselves Bumblebee saying, "This is the predictable result of media hysteria for decades over the climate, quote, crisis. We've moved from global warming to climate change to extreme wet weather." Bumblebee says, "Models consistently overestimate warming." Will you fact check that for us, Andrew?
The world is warming, humans are the cause, almost the entire cause, according to a host of different lines of inquiry into the greenhouse gas role in that. And then the vulnerability that we see is being driven by this other thing, too, which is our human surge in places of danger. And that's where you can get pretty big arguments about how much of Storm X was from climate change or how much of it the losses were from where we build and how we build. Both of those things speak to opportunities to fix stuff. And the vulnerability is that I've met a host of libertarians who hate the idea that we subsidize people building in flood zones. And I know of also a bunch of libertarians and conservatives who are getting off the grid, not because of climate change, but because they don't want to pay a check to utility. So you don't even have to have that argument about sort of is climate a crisis or not. You can say we're in a vulnerable situation with the weather we have now, and we're doing a big, long-lasting jog to the system. Let's get engaged on both fronts. And again, the Green New Deal has both of those things in it. That gets lost in the headlines. And the youth movement, I think, can build on both of those, and that can lead over the long haul with urgency and patience to some better outcomes.
Well, let's go to Sarah, who's calling from Zion, Illinois. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm an elementary school teacher, and this issue is the most stressful issue for me as a teacher because we do not address it hardly at all. And, I mean, it is in the curriculum a bit for science, but then we just forget about it and move on to other things because the school districts are so microscopically focused on test scores, reading, writing, test scores. They don't want to do anything else. And plus, it's a little bit of a political issue because very few, and from my perspective, very few teachers, administrators see this problem as such an urgent problem. And also in elementary school, these kids could so easily be, it's just so depressing. I mean, we teach them about endangered species that are just going to be gone in a couple years. And at the same time, there's such a great opportunity to get them involved in hands-on activities that would get them in touch with the natural world. They could go outside and build a garden. They could do little things that could help. But the districts would, no districts that I know are interested in doing any of that because they don't think it's helpful for raising their test scores.
Ah, well, Sarah, thank you so much for your call. Yeah. Tom Mayer, was that you agreeing or was that Andrew?
Oh, it was Andy. My wife is an environmental educator, so we kind of live this stuff all the time. And this is where there is a way forward, and it's finding ways in a classroom, if there is a motivated teacher, that aren't like more work, but that get the kids doing the learning. And this leads away from polarization in politics. And one thing I was so interested in, Geographic, where I just started a year ago, they used to have this thing called geoliteracy program. You know, teachers, where is Botswana? That's a, you know, answer, A, and you get an A. Now it's geo-inquiry. So the more the kids can be leading the learning, then with a sense of where the facts are, then you can kind of depoliticize these situations and have classrooms become laboratories for exploration that really kind of avoid those some of those issues with what the other things that teachers and students have to deal with.
Yeah, well, we've just got under 2 minutes left to go. And Tom Mayer, I wanted to ask you a question that's been raised here by one of our online commenters. Mike L. says, nice overture, but I don't think it'll work. The target audience are baby boomers and some remaining Depression-era folks living high off government retirement and health care. They are not listening to anything not related to that. I'm wondering if that's a fundamental challenge for any youth movement that's asking for long-term change. To be made by people who may not be alive to experience the benefits of that long-term change.
Absolutely. And that's a challenge that most movements face, is that you're challenging the status quo, and there's lots of people that are very happy with the way that things are and are, or at the very least, okay with the way things are. And you have to either A, convince them that they should change their opinion on that, or B, that you have to convince people with the ability to make policy change to make changes against those individuals' interests. Mm. And so it is a challenge that not only youth movements face, but broader movements face. But youth movements in particular, they face this challenge because, again, they're seen as not having the knowledge or experience or the real world awareness to have an understanding of these topics or issues that they clearly do, even though they clearly do.
Yeah. Well, Krishna Ariola, we've got about 30 seconds left here. I mean, you're speaking to an American audience. What's your final message for them? Why do you think it's urgent to act now?
Again, as I said, we rank third in climate change vulnerability, the Philippines. And at the same time, we're the country that contributes so little to the global carbon emissions. And we are calling actually for climate justice because your emissions, your country's emissions, have the effect on us. We are the ones experiencing the typhoons, the landslides. We have to build and rebuild our lives around this every single day. And for you, this is an abstract concept, but for us, this is our daily reality.
Right.
And we are humans, too. And this is our world as well. And
yeah. Well, Krishna, I'm going to have to take it back to you from there. I'm sorry, we just got 10 seconds left. But Krishna Ariola, Andrew Revkin, and Tom Mayer, thank you so very much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.